May all beings be happy, may all beings be healthy, may all beings be free from harm, may all beings love life, may all beings awaken. Welcome to another Kuk Audio Podcast. I'm DC Pupa of Kuk Audio and Kuk Archives, preserving the legacy of Shunryu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his, and anything else that comes to mind. I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable, free from economic hardship, and able to get out and do whatever it is you want within the limitations of the universal precept of do as little harm as possible. So we have a guest today, Norm Randolph, and I've got two interviews with him here. Well, I've got a phone chat 26 years ago. And I've got one from a couple of days ago. So I'm going to start with just reading the one that's on Kuk.com, interview with Norm Randolph. Nice photo of him there. But first, let's have our pause to meditate. So when you hear the bell, if you're of such a mind, hit pause. Meditate or just sit there, whatever, for a little bit or as long as you like. And when you're ready to come back, just hit unpause, and we'll be there to hit the bell to end the meditation, and we'll get on with Norm. Norman Randolph. I never call him Norman. Norm Randolph is a Dharma heir of Dainin Katagiri Roshi, who teaches with Steve Hagen at the Dharma Fields Zen Center in Minneapolis. Here's that site's bio on Norm. You notice he doesn't mention he studied with Suzuki. This I take as Norm modesty. He never puts himself first or makes any claims. Norm Randolph, this is from the site, Dharma Fields Zen Center. Norm Randolph is a senior teacher at Dharma Fields. Born in San Francisco in 1943, he graduated from the University of California at Berkeley with a psychology degree and worked in an Air Force psychiatric clinic. In 1969, he met Dainin Katagiri Roshi in San Francisco and moved to Minneapolis when Katagiri Roshi went there. In 1972, he was ordained in 1978 and received Dharma transmission in 1989. His life he has retired from his position as a patient transporter at Minneapolis Hospital. And then I say, Norm and I shared a room at Tassajara for the summer of 1971. We had a lot of fun talking at night before going to sleep. I don't want to detract from what he has to say here by going on about him, except to say that everybody loves Norm. So here we are, Norman Randolph in Minneapolis over the phone with DC, September 16th, 1995, just about exactly 26 years ago. The first time I saw Suzuki Roshi, he was standing at the top of the stairs at the Bush Street Zendo in 1969, and I'd never seen anybody who stood there in the way that he did. It was very impressive. There seemed to be very powerful stillness that I'd never seen with anybody else before. I don't believe it my own projections that made me so impressed by him. I think the reason he was so impressive just standing there is that most people don't just stand there. When they stand, they have so much busy mental activity that you don't get the feeling of powerful peacefulness that he had. I was very much impressed with that. One thing I noticed about him that I really admired is that he seemed to do things 100% when he'd work in his rock garden or do the Orioki. You'd sense him 100% in the activity. It was a very beautiful thing to see. I can't describe it beyond saying he was 100% there in a way that was completely appropriate to the situation. I was so impressed by how he ate with Orioki. You know, that's the wrapped bowls that are used to eat at Zen Center in the Zendos, like Tassara practice period. And the formal eating, it's like a ceremony, how you unwrap it, how you put the various utensils and things out, and how you put it back together, and you wash your bowls before you put them back together. Anyway, as you may remember, I had somewhat of an eating problem in the Zendo and elsewhere. I might add, like the time that I drank that 5-pound jar of honey in our room. Wow. Man, I'd forgotten that. Anyway, I had a kind of reputation for gluttony, and sometimes I'd modify the Orioki rules to fit around that desire. I developed my own style of Orioki to maximize the intake. I made attempts to follow the path of wakefulness and mindfulness, but at mealtime, I would abandon that practice in order to indulge this gluttony, which came from very deep in my psychic and karmic history. One day when Peter Schneider was head monk, Tatsugami Roshi had seen me get thirds in the Zendo a few times. There would be 4 servers for the 4 rows of the Zendo, and if the server on the other side got delayed, I'd finish up my seconds real quick and put my hands in gassho, and the server would think the one on my row had run out of food, and I'd have an earnest expression on my face, and I'd get thirds. Tatsugami sent Peter to admonish me in a very kind way, but he also told a story about himself when he was at Eiheiji and on how he'd really liked rice balls and how he'd load up on them till there was no room for more in the bowl, and then he'd signal the server one more, and then he'd take his chopstick and stab it before it would roll on the floor. It was a nice way of encouraging me to do a little better. In the summer of 71, Suzuki Roshi was down there and giving lecture every night, and one time I looked up at him during breakfast, and he was doing Orioki, and it looked like he was doing it for the first time, 100% there. The same with working with him in the rock garden. Nils and I would work with him. He asked me to come help Nils, his jisha, to lift rocks because I was so big and strong, and it was really wonderful working with him. I don't know why it would be so beautiful to see the way he would act. He'd be 100% present in what he was doing, and it seemed like exactly the right thing for the right time. You can't describe it. You have to see it. And it was very beautiful, his warm personality. Once Nils and I were horsing around trying to decide who was the strongest, and I was saying Nils was the strongest, and he was trying to say I was the strongest, and Suzuki Roshi cracked up at that. He thought it was so ridiculous. He had a beautiful sense of humor. He'd see humor in all sorts of places. I was sitting at Page Street in a session, my knee was bad, and I was using a chair, and my chair was on the edge of the platform, which was only about 6 inches at the time, and he came up behind me and tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned around, and he pointed at the leg on the edge. He had a kind of twinkle in his eye and was kind of amused by it all. You had a feeling that he saw you completely. Anything that you were trying to hide, he saw. He saw you as you were. But you also had a feeling that he totally accepted you and that he cared about you very much and that he didn't have an agenda for you. He wasn't trying to run something past you. He cared about you and saw you very clearly and sincerely wished the best for you, whatever that was. I remember I went to see him one time and said, I'd like to be ordained as a monk. And the first thing he said right away was, layman or monk, there's no difference. There was something very wonderful about him, and it's hard to describe because you had to feel the vibrations of his situation and the situation that you're in with him so that you can feel the humor and the joy in his way of life. There was a feeling of deep caring and seeing people with precision. There was no way someone could bullshit him. During the summer of 71, when I had most of my contact with him, he said, when I see somebody whose practice is very good, I wish I was younger. I think he saw there were a lot of people who had a great enthusiasm for following his way, and he was sorry he wasn't going to be around to help them. I'll never forget him walking across the floor being held up by his son at Baker Roshi's mountain seat ceremony and him crying, Norman choking, most everyone else too, actually as he was walking out. I'm starting to cry now as I think of it. But I think that he actually cared about people, and he was sorry to have to leave them. D.C. When I was ordained by him with Ed and Angie and Lou, he wasn't there. Katagiri did it for him, and we went to his bed, and he thanked us, and I looked at him, and he was being so grateful and kind, and I realized that he was dying, and I went up on the roof and cried. I just had to be by myself. Norm. That's the kind of feeling he inspired. I think he was crying because he wanted to help all these people who wanted to follow him and who he cared about a lot. That's my projection on the situation. DC, comment again. I never heard anybody say, and I have many, many, many people commenting on that ceremony. I've never heard anybody say they saw him crying. That's interesting. And Norm is not the type of person to elaborate, that's something he perceived. So Norm says he was from the heart 100%, but he had this real puckish, impish humor that would just cut through the solemnity of the situation, and that was one thing you were good for at Tassajara, and you were really good at cutting through the pomposity. Once you get caught up in that, you really go down a slippery slope into a very ugly practice. It says here, we're laughing. It's essential to the health of the community to have some Zen lunatics. And if the teacher incorporates that crazy, impish quality like Suzuki Roshi did, then you can really have a beautiful community, which it was. In the forms of practice, you can see a person's state of mind. If they're doing it in a sloppy way or a pride-filled way, you can see where the person is. It's evident in the forms. If you see somebody who's really doing it, it looks completely natural, like how Katagiri would bow, not forced or arrogant or pompous in any way. I'd watch him bow before a lecture, and it would seem to come out of the circumstances of the moment. It wasn't always that way with Zen people. Suzuki Roshi said that the forms of practice he'd use like the sights on a gun. by looking at how students bowed and did oryoki or wore their robes, he was able to see their state of mind. It was in a lecture called Warm-Hearted Practice, delivered in March of 71 at Tassajara, when he came down for Peter Shuso's ceremony, and I think he stayed and gave it the day before or after. That's really nice. Thank you, Norm. All right, well, we got that down. Now let's let's go to the phone chat with Norm. And, you know, we started off talking about personal things. So it just sort of starts off with him, you know, making a statement. So there's no "Hi, Norm" or any of that on it.
I do some teaching, not as much as I used to. I'm a little bit slowed down mentally now, but I still can do a little teaching, but not as much as I used to.
What do you teach?
Just about Zen practice and Zen stories, things like that.
Oh, and that's at Dharma Fields?
Yeah, Dharma Field. That's a Zen center in Minneapolis.
And who's the founding teacher?
Steve Hagen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's written some books on Zen.
Yeah, sure. Sure. I know who that is.
He's a student of Katagiri Roshi's. And
yeah.
He and I have been here for some time teaching.
Yeah. Oh, that's neat. That's neat. Now, Katagiri had a number of Dharma heirs. Nonin, who's in Omaha, and
right.
Tim, who's got the Minneapolis Zen Center. Steve.
Yeah, Tim. I think no longer head teacher at Zen Center, but he's there as kind of a co-teacher.
Uh-huh.
Those guys are getting old, so we're teaching less.
Yeah, I've noticed that. People are retiring teaching, and some disappear. I don't know where they go.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice. That's neat. Well, when did you come to Minneapolis?
1972.
Wow. Is that when Katagiri went there?
Right.
Yeah. He was even doing stuff at the Zen Center in 72.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, he continued having a relationship with the Zen Center, through the years. Wasn't very satisfying to him because, anyway, that's an old story. Things continue not necessarily as perfectly as we would have them, huh?
Yeah, that's true.
What you arrived in 72, what did you do?
Well, I was participated in the activities of the Zen Center, and I worked for many years as a kind of nursing assistant and transporter in a hospital. And I was ordained as a priest, and I did some teaching.
Well,
but nothing too much.
Well, that is definitely right livelihood, working in a hospital.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Well, you've done right livelihood too. You've written some great books.
Well, thank you. They're actually all written by what I was around, what I've been around, the people I've been around, and everything.
Yeah.
You know, I've just reported on what I've seen and heard.
Well, you did a good job.
Thank you. I humbly appreciate that. When did you first come to the San Francisco Zen Center?
1969, shortly before they moved to Page Street.
Sokoji. Yeah.
Yeah, I came, and it was summer of 69.
Yeah.
And went to some sessions. Well, actually, I participated in that moving of Zen Center to Page Street.
Yeah, that pretty much happened in one day, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you there? I don't remember seeing you there.
No, I was. I was studying Japanese. Pardon?
You were at Tassajara, probably.
Yeah, I was studying Japanese in Monterey that summer. Well, the second half. Well, actually, the move happened in November, but
November.
The second half of the summer, I studied Japanese intensively in Monterey. The first half, I was running the dining room at Tassajara. I continued that through the fall. And I would go to the cities, you know, sometimes on a weekend to hear Suzuki lecture. I was mainly involved in the Monterey, Carmel Valley for, I don't know, about 5 months there. And then, I went back to Tassajara. Then, as I recall, when I went, you and I were roommates for quite some
time. That's right.
Yeah.
That was in 1971.
71. Yeah.
Yeah. Summer of 71, we were roommates.
Yeah. And, right. You were a good roommate. You're very thoughtful.
Yeah, you were too. I have very good memories of that time.
Yeah, yeah, we got along. So, hey, how did you get there? What led you to come to Zen Center?
Well, I was just very much attracted to Zen practice, and I heard that there was a monastery there and a great teacher to, you know, in Suzuki, and I was all fired up about it. So I heard about it, I became involved in the Berkeley and San Francisco Zen Centers.
Oh, Berkeley too, huh? Mm.
Yeah, I lived in Berkeley. I had a job at the post office, and then I'd come over to San Francisco for sessions, and as soon as I could do so, I applied to Tassajara, and they let me go.
Yeah. Well, where did you come from?
Where did I come from?
Yeah.
I was born in San Francisco, and I grew up in Berkeley.
Oh, really? I had no idea. Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know anybody actually came from there.
Yeah.
No, there's...
Yeah, well, I'm...
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah. Yeah. Born in San Francisco, grew up in Berkeley. That's pretty nice place to grow up, don't you think, Berkeley?
I think so, yeah. There were a lot of nice things about Berkeley in those days. I haven't been there in a long time. I don't know what it's like now, but it was real nice back then.
I think I haven't been in America since 2013, but I was...
Yeah, I saw that you're living in Indonesia.
Yeah, that's right. We're living in Bali. And me and my lovely wife, Katrinka.
I've never met her, have I?
No.
Probably not.
I don't think so. She was born in Manhattan, but she came to the Bay Area in 65, and I came in 66. So you said you were interested in Zen. Why were you interested in Zen? Or why were you interested? What made you interested in Zen? What made you come to the Zen Center, and you said you were, what got you interested? Where does it start?
I was with reading. I got interested through reading.
Reading what?
The first book was Alan Watts.
Which one?
The Way of Zen. And then, I read some other books too, but that... I remember that made an impression on me, and I was looking for something to get involved with, something that made more sense than just looking to try and establish a career in a profession. You know, I was very much impressed with what I'd heard about Zen.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get involved in it.
Hmm. Hmm.
And when I heard about Tassajara, that made a big impression on me.
Yeah.
And I went to the Zen Center office and talked to Silas Hoadley. He was in charge of the Zen Center office at that time, he and Yvonne. And I was very impressed with Silas. He showed me the brochures for Tassajara and Zen Center, and it just looked like this would be a place I really like to get involved with.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And Silas was such a wonderful person to have around, too.
Yeah. Yeah. He was.
He was. He was really. Second to Richard Baker in Suzuki's eye, as far as I could see, it was really, really, those were great years when Suzuki was alive and everybody could get along. and things weren't that bad after he died, but... Silas didn't feel, after a while, he didn't feel there was room for him anymore. But that's good. People need to leave,
Sure, they go on to their own things. I think he was teaching up in Port Arthur, Washington for a while.
He moved to Port Townsend. He's still there.
Oh, what was it?
Port Townsend.
Port Townsend?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he'd go... He really wasn't teaching in Port Townsend much. He never had a group, but he would go do sessions for people, like for Larry Hansen up in Quadra Island, and he kept to, he stuck to around the Northwest there. And Nils moved to Port Townsend. I've done three book signings in Port Townsend. I love Port Townsend. And there was one of them, I counted seven former students of the early Zen Center, back in the Suzuki days. That was neat. Do you have any memories of Suzuki Roshi?
Well, I remember how impressed I was by him, and it was hard to put your finger on it, but it just seemed like he was really living his life as it should be lived.
What do you remember when you first met him?
Well, I remember the first time I saw him, it was at Sokoji, and he was standing at the top of the stairs after Zazen, and he was just about to go down and give the lecture, and I was very impressed with the stillness that he showed.
Hmm.
It was just very powerful, seemed to me to be a very powerful state of stillness.
Hmm. Hmm. Hmm.
I'm sure you noticed that too about him.
Do you have any particular memories of Tassahara?
Oh yeah, lots of memories of Tassahara. Lots of good memories.
Anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, it was a great place to be, and I liked the people there, and it was a great opportunity to listen to Suzuki and Katagiri.
Mm-hmm.
Felt just a great opportunity, and so yeah, I don't know. It just very happy time of my life.
Mm, mm. And how long were you there? You were there 1 year?
About a year, almost 2 years.
Yeah.
I left after about a year and 9 months, something like that. Barbara and I were going to have a baby, and we moved to Monterey.
Oh, you moved to Monterey when Katagiri started that group there,
Yeah, it was about 6 months after he started it.
Oh, really?
And we went there shortly before our baby was born.
Hmm. Hmm. Mm. And how's your baby?
Well, he's getting up there now. He's about 49, I think, and he's a big guy. He's bigger than I am, and
whoa!
He's a real nice guy, and he has three children.
Mm-hmm.
He's married, and he has his own business. I'm not sure exactly. It's something about getting supplies to people. But anyway.
That's funny. Well, that's nice. Is he there in Minneapolis?
He's in one of the suburbs, maybe 20, 30 miles away.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's good.
I have another son who has, he lives in another suburb, and he has two daughters.
Hmm. So how many grandkids you got?
Five.
Yeah.
There are two boys, and the rest are girls. The boys are twins.
Oh, I see. Huh, that's neat. You know, one thing I remember about you at Tassahara is the reason I asked if you there... 71. So didn't you come in 70?
In the fall of 70.
Right, right.
I sat in a chair.
Oh, you did?
For a while, I did.
What was wrong
then
with you?
I had some problems with my knees, but I eventually was able to get down on the floor.
Uh-huh. What was the problem with your knees?
I don't know. It would go out of place something wrong with the ligaments or something. I don't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
But it eventually got better.
Yeah. How tall are you?
I'm 6'2 now. I used to be taller, but I've shrunk a little.
How tall were you back then?
6'3.
Yeah. And you were not only tall, you weren't overweight. You were hefty or something. I don't know, what would you call
it? Yeah.
You were...
muscular.
You were muscular, man. And, you know, one thing I remember is... maybe I was work leader when you were there.
Yes, you were.
I was work leader. And
and a damn fine man, too, I might add.
Oh, thank you. were you on trash and recycling?
Yeah, I did the garbage job for a while.
Yeah. Do you remember the thing you liked to do the most?
I used to like to smash things.
That's right. And you would, look, we'd be like this. There would always be stuff building up, like cans to flatten, and I don't know, I can't remember. And I'd say, you'd come to me and, you know, you'd say, you know, maybe there was this or that, you know, I wanted you to go out and do so-and-so. And when it was done, you'd say, Dave, maybe I can go smash some cans now.
I remember you used to tease me about that.
Oh, yeah, you were good. Well,
in a good-natured way.
Yeah, well, of course. There was one. Is this a right man? I remember we had a big concrete slab we had to get rid of. And I thought, oh, boy, I know who'd like to do that. Because you love to use a sledgehammer. Do you remember?
Yeah, that's true. I did.
And you know, it was like we thought, well, maybe we got to rent a jackhammer or something to get rid of that thing. I said, well, I think I know somebody who can take care of it.
That's right. Yeah. I used to love doing that.
And there was also one. There was a problem with some cowboy guests who were, you know, had guns and were...
Down to the baths?
Yeah, they went down to the baths, and one of them went into the pool. Did he go into the pool with his horse? I think he might have.
I don't remember that. I remember there were some guys who... they came in and just kind of were acting belligerent and everything.
Yeah. They weren't that. I knew who they were. They were from, you know, out in the Jamesburg area. They knew the Lamberts and all that. I really wasn't worried about them. They were just drunk and unruly. God, they went to the women's side of the baths. And there was this woman there that was horrified and complained at the office. But did you have anything to do with dealing with them?
I just talked to them, and I wasn't confrontational with them. I just talked to them, kind of let them say what they wanted to say, and they didn't seem to offer much trouble.
Yeah.
They calmed down and left, and there were a number of people who did that.
Then what I remember is you and Mark Alexander were the people that, and you're both strong. You're bigger. You're like a foot taller than Mark Alexander. No, you're maybe 4 inches, 5 inches taller than him. But I don't know where I was or what. I think that was when I was director, like in 1971. I remember talking to him, I made them check their guns. I always found that even like people you were, you know, were a little unruly or something, you got to check your guns. It was sort of a manly thing to do. They, oh, all right, check our guns. You know, it's a big place, so they needed to be dealt with, and you and Mark just stepped up to the occasion, and Mark just told them they had to go, you know.
And Mark what?
He told them they had to go, and they did.
Oh.
They did, but also you were being firm, but... You know, you're not the type to give commands. And he isn't either. He's pretty soft-spoken. You all sort of let him know it was they'd had their fun. And anyway, yeah, we had worse people than that come in.
I didn't meet up with any really bad people. I mean, they were basically pretty nice, even though they might have had a little too much to drink or something.
But yeah, yeah.
Basically, the people were pretty nice.
Yeah, I always found that combination of alcohol and guns in the woods to be a little unnerving.
Yeah, that's not a good idea.
I was over in Arroyo Seco once, and I crossed the horse bridge. And there was a guy with like an Uzi or an AK-47, one of these like semi-automatic guns like you see in the movies. And he just started shooting it like into the hills. And I said, excuse me, sir, but I have friends over there. They're coming in. That's where the trail is. I said, I also had a friend who killed somebody in the woods doing that. And it really was something he had to deal with for a long time. And the guy.
Yeah, I bet that's right.
Yeah. Yeah, just shot into the woods. He was a teenager in a national forest where there was no hunting. And it wasn't in Texas. It was in Colorado. He and some friends had gone up there for some reason. And some kid came running out crying and they killed his father.
Yeah, it's tragic.
Wow. Why were you attracted to Katagiri?
I liked his personality, and I was very much moved by the things he said.
Mm-hmm. After Suzuki died, you just wanted to, you just wanted him to be your teacher, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. When you were in Monterey there with Barbara, did you get a job?
Yeah, I was a garbage man.
There you go again.
The fact that I'd worked as garbage man at Tassajara helped me get that job.
Oh, seriously?
I told them I had previous experience.
Wow.
And so they said they were really impressed with my previous experience, although it was nothing like what I did at the Monterey Garbage. But
what was it?
I told them previous experience. They got excited about that and hired me the next day.
Wow. That's terrific. What? Can you hear that?
It sounds like something like a chainsaw.
I do have a carpenter that's arrived. I haven't talked to him yet, but he's doing something. What was it like being I've always wanted to be a garbage. I was always attracted to clean up, garbage, recycling, and
that's
alternative
great.
Sewage disposal stuff like that. You know, I built compost privies and.
Well, I remember that garbage run we did down to Monterey Recycling. We had a huge load of garbage that, from Tassajara we took down there. You know, not garbage, but stuff to be recycled.
Oh, recycle run. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, recycle run. We that was a good time, I remember.
Oh, we. Oh, did you go with me when I took all this stuff out of the metal? We had like a yard where big things had been kept, and you know, old pipe and wire and bed frames and parts of cars and just different things.
There was all sorts of stuff on the truck when we took it down to Monterey.
Yeah, there was stuff that had been building up there for decades, you know, in previous owners. I remember when Paul Disco came back, he was disappointed that I had sold the copper and brass and stuff because he wanted to make a bell out of it. I did a stupid thing. I took all the wire, and you get more for wire if it doesn't have insulation covering on it, you know?
Yeah.
So I took all this wire, and, you know, I wasn't really thinking about air pollution or anything there. I mean, the air was just perfectly clear and clean, and any burning we did, you know, just went off. We never noticed it again. So I took all this wire. There was a lot. I filled like a 55-gallon drum just full of wire with insulation and covering. And I took it out to Grasshopper Flats. And I put it, you know, in an area where there's just dirt. It's cleared all around. I guess maybe we'd burn stuff there sometimes. We didn't do a lot of burning. But we'd have a bonfire there some, you know, like twice a year or something. So I put that can there and I poured some gasoline in it. Right? And then I lit it and, oh my God, it sent up a dark black cloud like a mile into the sky. And I ran to the phone, which is, you know, how far is the phone from there? A few hundred yards. Maybe.
Yeah, that's right. To the office would be about 200.
200, right. 200 yards.
Yeah.
Man, and I called the, you know, I knew how to get hold of the Forest Service and the lookouts and everything right away. I said, hey, look, I told him what I did. I said, I said, anyway, it's all under control and everything. And I didn't realize that it would do this much. But then Paul was sorry I sold all that. Huh, well, and anything else you want to share?
Well, it's good to hear from you, David. I have very fond memories of our time there at Tassajara.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, it was a great experience for me.
Well, you were a very dependable person, and you were quite unselfish. So, there's people who would run for me in my various jobs as work leader. I was work leader in all three places, you know, in the city and at Green Gulch.
Yeah,
because I would, I just always wanted to keep getting things done. And I remember when I had the job of fixing up and cleaning out the home at Muir Beach that Zen Center bought, that Mayumi Oda and then Peter and Wendy Johnson ended up living in. So I got the job of, you know, I'd moved out from Zen Center and was living with Liz Twomey and Belinas. But I always had another place at Zen Center, so somewhere around Zen Center, I'd spend half the time there. And so I needed to get people to help me. And I remember one guy said, yeah, he'd work on the house as long as he wasn't under me, because he knew. Oh. I would be endlessly slave driving him and wanting him to do.
Oh, no, you were a great work leader. you're a great work leader.
Well, look, you give my love to any of our mutual friends. You know who I've been dealing with recently, who's in Minneapolis, is Jeff Broadbent. Yeah, he's just retired this year as a sociology professor at the university there. And I'm going to be, I'm going to go over a book he's written on, you know, sociology around climate change. I do not like to go over people's books. I'm really not qualified. But I thought this was important.
Oh, you're a great writer. Those books you wrote were great books. Truly great books.
Oh, thanks, thanks. But you know, when I'm doing writing, I do music too. I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm not really educated in a sense, you know. So I'm not really a good person to tell other people. I just sort of go. Anything I read or hear anything, I go, oh yeah, that's nice. you know, editors are different. But anyway, I think I can help with this mainly. I think it's there's good stuff. You know, there's so much good information that comes from academic studies that is translated by science writers in news departments. BBC and Guardian, I start the day by looking at their science pages, and then I don't go to the news. Yeah. so I sort of feel that way about this. I think maybe something could come out, but we'll see. We'll see. And anyway, Minneapolis has many Zen students. Many Zen Center students came from Minneapolis.
Yeah.
What I noticed in the early days of Tassajara, that the three places that tended to have a lot of people coming were New York City, Texas, and Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why Texas now. I remember saying that thing. In fact, yeah. It ended up being in Time magazine that most of the students came from there, but that isn't what I said.
Well,
I said there were a lot that came from those places. Well, okay, Norm. Good talking to you. And
it's good talking to you, David.
And what's the name of the Zen group you're with there?
Dharma Field.
Dharma Field. So the somebody wants to check it out. There's a website like dharmafield.com.
Yeah, dharmafield.org.
Dharmafield.org. I wanted to talk to you, and I'm glad we did. And take care. Until we meet
again.
Yeah,
well, thanks a lot, David.
Yeah.
This brings back very happy memories hearing from you.
Yeah. Okay. Bye-bye, Norm.
Yeah, bye-bye, David. Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you very much, Norm Randolph. A good person. And I'm sure you're a good teacher up there in Minneapolis. This has been a Cuke Audio podcast. I'm DC Poobah of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, coming to you from Sleepy Sonora with Doggett Bandita, Filancuchita, and dear lovely Katrinka. And we're wishing you and yours and all of us a grand awakening.